Hey there. Welcome back to the Get Legit Law and Shit podcast. Today we're talking about the Breonna Taylor decision. The case went to a grand jury in the state of Kentucky. The attorney general made his findings, made his decision, and presented that to the public last week. And there are still a whole lot of feelings about it. So we are going to talk about that decision, break down what happened, and some of the questions that have come out since that decision was released. Friends, there is a lot to talk about today. So let's get into it.
Hey there, this is Get Legit Law and Shit, and I'm Emily D. Baker, badass lawyer for online business. I've been a licensed attorney for over 15 years, and I'm a former prosecutor. So yeah, I know some shit, and we're going to talk about the legal shit you need to know. But don't worry, this is not another boring business podcast. So let's get started.
Well, before we get all the way into it, I am recording this addendum to this episode after I recorded the rest of the episode because shit keeps changing. And the Attorney General of Kentucky made an additional statement that we need to talk about real quick. And a grand juror in the Breonna Taylor grand jury is asking the court for permission to speak. Now, normally grand jurors are court ordered to secrecy, which means they can be criminally responsible, criminally liable if they say shit when they don't have permission to. In this case, an attorney for that particular juror gave a press conference saying that the grand juror wants to make sure that what was presented to the grand jury is publicly disclosed and that there is a concern regarding the truth and transparency of the grand jury proceeding. Now, some of this, I think, is addressed in the statement made by the Attorney General in Kentucky. And that statement that was released after I recorded this episode is, and I'm quoting, "The grand jury is meant to be a secretive body. It's apparent that the public interest in this case isn't going to allow that to happen. As the special prosecutor, our team has an ethical obligation not to release the recording from the grand jury proceedings, and we stand by our belief that such a release could compromise the ongoing federal investigation and could have unintended consequences such as poisoning the jury pool. Despite these concerns, we will comply with the judge's order to release the recording on Wednesday. The release of the recording will also address the legal complaint filed by an anonymous grand juror. We have no concerns with grand jurors sharing their thoughts on our presentation because we are confident in the case we presented. Once the public listens to the recording, they will see that over the course of 2.5 days, our team presented a thorough and complete case to the grand jury. Our prosecutors presented all of the evidence, even though the evidence supported that Sergeant Mattingly and Detective Cosgrove were justified in their use of force after having been fired upon by Kenneth Walker. For that reason, the only charge recommended was wanton endangerment. Now, I bring this up later in this episode that we weren't clear whether the grand jury was presented with the other charges, and now it is clear that the grand jury was not asked to decide whether or not the other officers had killed Breonna Taylor under one of the 6 homicide statutes in Kentucky. It is now clear from that statement that the Attorney General's office made that determination, which is consistent with the Attorney General's statement that you'll hear me repeat again later, but I'm going to repeat again now in context that, and this is a quote directly from the Attorney General at his press conference, "According to Kentucky law, the officers were justified in returning deadly force after they were fired upon, and this justification bars us from seeking criminal charges in the death of Miss Breonna Taylor." So with going forward with this episode that I recorded before this information came out, I am still sharing the rest of that episode because the analysis still stands. We are going to find out more information. We now know that the grand jury did not choose not to indict those officers, but that the Attorney General's office chose not to ask for an indictment on those charges. And the Attorney General seems to think that that clarifies what the juror is seeking to say. And we won't know until a court decides whether that juror can speak and to what extent that juror is allowed to speak. So there's going to be more on this, and we're going to be here to talk about it. So let's get into the rest of this episode. At the time I'm recording this, there is still more information coming forward in the Breonna Taylor case. And by information, I mean things that are being leaked to different media outlets. There are things that have been leaked, investigative reports. There has been responding officer body cam video that's come out. Down the road, that'll all come by way of public records requests. I'm sure somebody has already requested all of those body cam footage. Body cam footage can be gotten by public records request. Someone is going to pull all of that and dig through it. Right now, I'm frustrated because I'm finding that the headlines are particularly misleading with regards to things like ballistics reports, conflicting ballistic reports, what the Attorney General said, what it actually meant. I find that my particular skill set as a, you know, former criminal prosecutor and attorney for over 15 years comes in really helpful when breaking down this case. I have worked on multi-search warrant task forces, not breaking down doors and serving warrants, but reading warrants, reviewing warrants, arguing warrants in court, supporting warrants in court, things like that. So I do find that breaking down that stuff is helpful. And then there are a few lingering questions that I'm getting quite a lot that I'm going to go ahead and answer in this podcast based on my experience. Because the thing at the end of the day is I am not here to defend anyone in this. I'm here to break down the facts as I see them, given my experience, and hopefully share some information so you can come to a conclusion about your feelings in this case. I feel that the information being shared has been hyped, for lack of a better word, on all sides. I feel that people definitely have drawn lines in the sand about, you know, police good, police bad, and that the narratives surrounding this case fall on one of those two lines. But police work is much more complex than black and white. People who haven't worked in law enforcement sometimes don't understand that. Yes, being a district attorney is law enforcement adjacent. It's not carrying a gun every day. Well, sometimes it's carrying a gun every day, but it's not carrying a gun every day to defend your communities. When district attorneys carry guns, it's to defend their own asses, which I fully support. Because if people want to kill you, you should be able to defend yourself against that. And that's what breaks down in this case here, too, is that at the end of the day, somebody shot at the police and the police shot back. That's what happened. Those are the facts. The facts of how to serve a search warrant, how the search warrant was served, how the search warrant was written, all become much more complex, but not super complex. What I'm seeing is that a lot of people just don't trust the Attorney General's statement of how this went down. And that is where a lot of this derision is coming from. I watched all of Attorney General Cameron's press conference. I thought he laid this case out clearly and concisely. I think he laid out information that we hadn't known before for fact. He broke down the decision-making process in the way that he could while there's still ongoing investigation into the search warrant and while there is now still an ongoing prosecution as to one of the officers who was indicted and appeared in court this week. As I'm recording this, it is the end of September 2020. So that officer appeared in court, pled not guilty, and will be going through the criminal justice process just as anybody else would. So by way of quick background, and I'm going to link in the show notes episode 39, where I break down all of the facts that we knew them at the time. What we know now is from Attorney General Cameron's statement, this was not served as a no-knock search warrant. However, since this incident happened, Breonna's law has been passed, which outlawed no-knock search warrants in the state of Kentucky and also included some additional policing reform things. I'm like lacking a word for policing reform implementations. Words are hard today, folks. And that is in the way search warrants are served, which will now require that officers be equipped with operating body cameras while executing search warrants, that the cameras must be activated 5 minutes prior to the service of the warrant and 5 minutes after, and that all video must be retained for 5 years. I did mention that body cameras can be gotten through public record requests, so I'm sure that SWAT departments do not love this ruling because it can allow people to study their tactics. And if you think that criminals won't go ahead and do that, they will. So it's going to require mindfulness on the part of the officers, and we want mindfulness on the part of the officers anyway. But this was part of Breonna's Law that was passed shortly after this incident happened. There's also been a civil settlement since this happened that was the largest civil settlement in a case like this that on record, like ever. And that's a $12 million settlement to Breonna Taylor's family. That also includes a number of provisions, including community connection programs is what they're calling it, with provisions to encourage officers to work more closely with their community in Louisville, giving officers different housing credits if they live within the urban city limits, encouraging community volunteering from the officers, and helping retain social workers to work alongside the police. It also includes search warrant reforms, requiring commanding officers to review and approve all search warrants. Often search warrants will be written and will go to a judge. Sometimes they'll be reviewed by attorneys or by other officers, but they're always reviewed by a judge. It's not as if search warrants are not reviewed. This is adding another review process, which in exigent cases where search warrants are need to be done quickly, I imagine that this is going to get to be a time crunch for them when they're dealing with destruction of evidence cases or where they're needing to get in to a location for exigency and kidnapping cases and things like that. But I don't doubt that they'll comply with their new operating procedures and find a way to make that work within their department. There are also some additional police accountability with regard to things like seizures of currency, drug testing, how personnel files are maintained, and things like that. So there were quite a lot of police reforms that are a part of this civil settlement that was entered into prior to the investigation concluding and the Attorney General announcing that officers would not be charged in this case, except for Officer Hankinson, who was charged with willful and wanton firing of a weapon. And we'll talk about what that wanton endangerment charge is in just a moment. So the grand jury, let me back up. The Attorney General's office did their investigation. They worked with the FBI in this investigation with regard to ballistics. The Attorney General announced a number of things in this case that we had not heard before, including that the determination was that this search warrant was not served as a no-knock, even though it was issued as a no-knock. Again, a no-knock search warrant means the police do not have to knock and announce that they are at your door. They can just come in and enter the premises to seize either people or items of evidence. The warrant being served at Breonna Taylor's apartment was being served for her location and her car. It was a search warrant, not an arrest warrant, which means they weren't there to arrest her. They were there to search her location in connection with this larger drug investigation. We know from leaked documents that that was a months-long ongoing investigation, that there was video investigation, there were recorded jail calls, and a lot of other things that went into that. Those are all things that the Attorney General's office would have had and could have presented to the grand jury. Why I say could have is because we will not know. I mean, unless the grand jury transcripts are released, which would surprise me, but they could be, we will not know exactly what was presented to the grand jury. Those are secret proceedings, which is fine. That's the way grand juries operate because they can be used as an investigative arm. And so the grand jury can be part of the investigative process, but then that is a secret proceeding. So when I say could have been presented, it's because these are things the Attorney General stated in the press conference, but we will not know exactly what was presented to the grand jury. So it was signed as a no-knock warrant. All the warrants that evening were issued as no-knock warrants. No-knock warrants require law enforcement to prove to a judge that there is a specific need for that warrant to be no knock. And that could be due to the relative danger. That could be for a lot of different reasons. The need to seize evidence that they are looking for could be easily destroyed if they are trying to look for a particular individual, the risk involved with that individual. So there is quite a lot that police need to prove to issue a no-knock warrant. The other warrants that evening, we have learned, were served in a no-knock fashion without incident, meaning the police just went right on in and arrested people, seized matters of evidence without incident. In this case, the attorney general tells us that the officers did knock and announce. Officers aren't going to knock and not announce because it puts them at risk. We've talked about having an issue in Kentucky and in other states where they have strong stand your ground laws that if you just come into somebody's house and they don't know who you are and they have a gun, they might shoot at you. And that's exactly what happened here. The police say they knocked and announced. The attorney general in his statement said that an independent witness corroborated that they knocked and announced. Just based on my experience and based on what I've seen with warrants served either in a no-knock fashion or with a knock and announce, if you're going to knock, you're going to announce. Because if you're going to knock like the police, which is not just a, it's a very specific knock. it is a very loud knock. You're not going to not announce who you are because that can cause problems. There's also been leaked crime scene photos that show a number of the officers in plain clothes, but with their vests on that clearly identify them as police. Now, whether Breonna Taylor's boyfriend saw that, we don't know. What he knew at the time he pulled the trigger at the people coming into his home is unknown. We can presume by the fact that he hasn't been charged with any crimes. Well, he was charged with crimes in connection with that, and those crimes were dropped, that either they don't find enough evidence to charge him with that, they've chosen to not charge him with that as an issue of justice, or they can't say that he did know that they were police in a way that they could prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that Kenneth Walker knew police were coming into his home and chose to shoot anyway. So Kenneth Walker filed upon police. What we learned in the attorney general's press conference that we did not know before is that Kenneth Walker was standing at the end of the hallway with Breonna Taylor. So they were at the end of the hall together, and that the officer saw the male holding a gun and fire immediately upon him, and he was shot in the leg. Now, the attorney general was very considered in stating that the ballistic evidence all supports that the officer who was shot in the leg with a 9mm round, and all the officers had 40mm weapons at the location. He also made clear that no other 9mm bullets were found, and I haven't seen anything that contests that. What I have seen are a whole lot of headlines saying, well, we don't know. We don't know if it was actually Kenneth Walker who shot the officer or if he was shot by friendly fire. This narrative, this dialogue seems to keep going around. However, if all the officers are shooting 40s and the officer shot in the leg with a 9, I mean, it indicates the person with the 9mm gun is the person who shot the officer. Also, depending on the medical urgency, though it has been reported that the officer who was shot, that he was hit in the femoral artery, which could very, very quickly lead to death. But there wasn't a lot of information about trajectory and whether trajectory of the bullet was determined before that officer went in and had surgery. So whether it came in from the front of the body or in from the back or the side of the body. But if they had known that, and they would probably have photos of the wound before he went into surgery, but not necessarily the case because it was emergent, they can determine that. But they did determine that it was a 9mm. What I'm seeing is that there were two ballistic reports, and the attorney general addressed this as well. There were two ballistic reports, and the Kentucky State Police report said, quote, due to the limited markings of comparative value, the 9mm bullet that hit and exited, so it wasn't a through wound, was neither identified nor eliminated as having been fired from Walker's gun. That doesn't mean that it wasn't shot. That means that they didn't ballistic match the gun and the bullet. So what they can do with bullets is look at the marking on them, depending on the shape of the bullet after it has, you know, entered through and passed through what's gone through. They can check the different types of markings that are left on the bullet or the bullet casings and then fire others from the same gun and then compare them and see if they are the same. What they're saying is they don't have enough comparative value to be able to determine if the bullet or the casing that was found is or had come from that particular gun. That's not saying that it could have come from one of the officer's guns. That's saying that they didn't ballistics match the X, you know, the bullet that was shot into the officer to that particular 9mm gun. That doesn't mean that a 40mm gun was shooting a 9mm round, because that's not how that works. So I don't find that to be, I hate to say, a smoking gun. That's the word that came into my head. I'm trying not to make light, but I don't find that to be as damning as all the headlines are saying that it is, because it's just saying that they didn't ballistics match it to that particular gun. It doesn't mean that there was an officer carrying a 9mm gun, though it has been said in the media that one of the officers present, I believe it was Hankinson, had at some point been issued a 9mm service weapon. But there's nothing to indicate that he was carrying that service weapon. And with the amount of rounds that they are saying Hankinson fired, there's no evidence that there's any other 9mm on the scene. So if there's one 9mm bullet and one 9mm casing and one person with a 9mm that says that they shot one time, which is what Kenneth Walker said, then there's no dispute over that, because all the evidence matches that that's exactly what happened. So looking into that deeper doesn't make any sense to me, because the person who fired the gun said they fired once, and the ballistic evidence shows that they fired once, and there aren't other conflicting bullets on the scene telling a different story. So I find that people are trying to make a lot out of that particular statement on that weapons report when it's really not a big deal, because it doesn't conflict with all of the other evidence relating the fact that Kenneth Walker says he shot, the officer was shot, there aren't any other 9mm bullets. I mean, sometimes it really just is what it is. And all of the facts regarding that particular part fit together. Even if they didn't ballistic match that bullet to that gun, they're not trying to prove that Kenneth Walker shot that officer in a court of law in the way that you would want to have that ballistics match, because they're not trying to say, oh, there were a bunch of other 9mm being fired. Nobody's disputing that Kenneth Walker fired, and no one's disputing that he fired first. So the dispute that, well, maybe he's not the one who shot the officer, or the officer was shot with friendly fire, doesn't make sense based on all of the surrounding circumstances, at least to me. It just doesn't. And I know that the reason that there's a conversation around that is because part of the self-defense argument that the officers have, that the attorney general walked through at the press conference, is that the officers were fired upon. So I think that the argument people are trying to make, even though they're not making it clearly, is that, well, if the officers weren't fired upon, then should they be charged? Well, they were fired upon. The officer was shot, and Kenneth Walker admitted that he shot the officer, so it's hard for me to wrap my head around a non-starter argument when the point is moot on that. It's the same with the no-knock warrant. If the warrant was served no-knock, would Kenneth Walker have had time to arm himself? Possibly not. That's the only conversation that really makes sense to me around serving a no-knock versus a knock-and-announce warrant. And when they're like, well, they knocked, but they didn't announce, again, it doesn't change the facts, and it doesn't change whether the officers are charged or not. It would only relate to whether Kenneth Walker was charged or not, and he's not currently charged. And I would be surprised if they resumed those charges. Those charges, he was initially arrested and charged, and those charges were dropped. And I would be very, very surprised if that was pursued again. I'd be very surprised. So with regard to the bullets, all of the evidence plus the witness statements all go towards Kenneth Walker is the one who shot the officer in the leg. But again, we're not prosecuting Kenneth Walker. No one is being prosecuted. So, well, except for Officer Hankinson, and we will get to the grand jury indictment of him. I know that the grand jury indictment was kind of confusing, especially the way the news media clipped into it. It was done via Zoom. So the first part of the judge even stating what they were doing kind of cut off. And then it was like, here's these three counts. And then it cut back out. And then the attorney general didn't speak for a while after that. I imagine that was because he was sitting down with Breonna Taylor's family explaining what was happening next before he gave the press conference, because until the charges or the indictment was officially made by the grand jury, it didn't make sense to sit down with Breonna Taylor's family and explain what was happening next until you knew what was happening next. And what was happening next is that the grand jury indicted Officer Hankinson of three counts of wanton endangerment. I've seen the memes online. I understand the frustration. All three charges of wanton endangerment stem from one apartment and three individuals in that apartment. The charge there of wanton endangerment is that, quote, a person is guilty of wanton endangerment in the first degree when, under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life, he wantonly engages in conduct which creates a substantial danger of death or serious physical injury to another person. So that is for Officer Hankinson, who fired without a clear line of sight. He was terminated at the end of the police investigation with regard to this incident in June of 2020. And then these are the charges. He will face three counts of the Class D felony, first degree wanton endangerment, which carry a 1 to 5 year sentence. And so that will be working its way through the criminal justice system in that he's been indicted. It will get ready to go to a criminal trial, or it will resolve prior to going to trial. And I imagine if that's what happens, it will be very, very unpopular. But when people don't have prior criminal records, it is very often that they don't end up going all the way through trial and the cases resolve short of trial. So that will be up to him and his defense team, and also up to the prosecutors if they offer anything or if they just say this has to go to trial. So those are the three charges that were indicted. What is still unclear is if the grand jury was given the opportunity to vote on whether they would issue an indictment for the other two officers. The attorney general said he walked them through the degrees of murder in Kentucky, the different types of homicide in Kentucky, but he didn't exactly specifically state whether they chose not to return an indictment or not. What he did make clear, and I'm quoting him here, is that according to Kentucky law, the officers were justified in returning deadly force after they were fired upon, and this justification bars us from seeking criminal charges in the death of Miss Breonna Taylor. So it seems to me that the grand jury was presented evidence that they were asked at least whether they were going to indict Officer Hankinson on the wanton endangerment, and that the attorney general's office made the decision that they were barred from seeking criminal charges. That's how I interpret that statement, but it was not explicitly said one way or the other. It left me with the impression that the grand jury evaluated those charges the way that the attorney general described how he presented the six different types of homicide laws that are applicable in Kentucky. So, getting into the questions that I've seen floating around quite a bit since this announcement, and there's a lot, but we're going to go through three, and I will post the article that I've taken these from, because these really summarize a lot of the questions that I have seen in comments on my YouTube videos regarding this, in comments on Instagram and in other people's posts. What I find frustrating is that people don't understand that this is an indictment and don't understand that sometimes when a prosecutor can't prove something beyond a reasonable doubt, they can't charge it. And no one likes that answer. And I understand why that answer feels incomplete, but that's also the right answer in this case. So one of the questions is, how could Hankinson be charged with wantonly endangering three of Taylor's neighbors by shooting into their homes, though it seems that it was one apartment, but not with endangering Taylor herself? And it might just be that that charge is inappropriate when you haven't endangered somebody, but when somebody has actually been killed, though that specific crux of that wasn't addressed, I would imagine some of the discussion around that would go, well, if they're justified in returning force, they're justified in all of the bullets that went into Taylor's apartment were justified based on how they were returning fire, but that the bullets that strayed into other apartments cannot be so justified. However, if that officer is firing blindly without line of sight, then it makes sense that it could endanger her. However, she was already placed in a position of greater danger from the other two officers that were shooting directly into the apartment, and one of them already being in the apartment who had been shot, and then his the other one who was right behind him, based on the way the attorney general described that. So it might just be that it doesn't fit right when there is actually a resulting death in that case, or based on the way that the bullets are, but there hasn't been an explanation of why there was no indictment for any of the shooting into Taylor's apartment other than the statement that I previously read about the homicide charges and about the fact that the officers were justified in returning deadly force. So as to that question, it is something that I feel that the attorney general could absolutely expand upon, or someone in his office could expand upon and explain why that is either appropriate or not appropriate under Kentucky law, or why that wasn't brought to the grand jury to decide. The next question is, even if Mattingly and Cosgrove had the right to defend themselves by returning fire against Walker after he shot at them and hit Mattingly, did they have justification to shoot and kill her, Breonna Taylor, an unarmed person who posed no threat? This is going to break down on proximity. And it seems from the way that this was described by the attorney general that Breonna Taylor and Kenneth Walker were standing immediately next to each other. So yes, that right to defend would extend based on the circumstances. Had she been elsewhere in the apartment, that fact scenario might have broken down differently. But on the facts that we have, they were standing right together at the end of the hallway. How she was hit and he wasn't is still a question that lingers in my mind. I don't understand if when they started firing, he dropped to the floor or if he ducked or moved. That does warrant some explanation and does leave a question. Does that question, if answered, change how this plays out? No. It just is an area where curiosity has been left. And how that went down, hopefully we will hear more from Kenneth Walker's interview, if he even remembers, because this is a young man that was in a situation under tremendous stress and his girlfriend was shot and killed while he was standing there, while officers were returning fire upon them after he fired on them. So if he remembers, I would be very interested to see how that all played out. But it doesn't change the situation here if the facts are as presented with them being together at the end of the hall. It just, their right to defend themselves covers that location. The final question that I've seen posed quite a lot is, getting back to this grand jury, did the grand jury even get to vote on whether Mattingly and Cosgrove should have been charged with any degree of homicide, or did Cameron decide that for them, that they acted in self-defense? Now, Cameron decides not for the grand jury, but for the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the grand jury is acting in an investigative capacity here to determine if charges should be brought versus just the Attorney General's office determining if charges should be brought. And it just isn't clear from the statement given by the Attorney General. However, it's not going to change the outcome. Either the grand jury can indict or the Attorney General's office can choose to bring charges. And he made very clear that they, the Attorney General's office and him, determined that there are no applicable statutes in this case because of the justification of self-defense. So even if they had voted or if he decided, it doesn't change the outcome, but I think it would help the public understand And the attorney general is an elected position. And that is a reasonable question to ask an elected official. How was this decided? I understand what you've said the law is, but who made the determination about what the law is in this case? And there are attorneys that will comment on both sides of this, a lot of them not former prosecutors, I will say, determine on both sides of this and say, you should let a jury decide the self-defense. But if the prosecutor finds that that self-defense claim can't be overcome, then it's not appropriate to file charges because you don't have a reasonable belief that you can prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury down the road. And in that case, it's not appropriate to bring the charges. So a little more clarity, I think, would help. But I think whatever the attorney general does at this point is just going to piss people off, and he might not feel the need to justify himself any further after he's made the statements that he made and after the conversations he has had with Breonna Taylor's family. Because at this point, everyone calling for more explanation are people outside the state of Kentucky. He made very clear in his statement that his obligation is to the people of the state of Kentucky and that he is keeping with that. So yes, there are some questions here that could be answered, but even if those questions are answered, it is not going to change the outcome here. These officers are not going to be charged. I said it in the first podcast that I didn't think the officers would be charged on the facts of this case. I think in all of the information we got from the attorney general that had the officers decided to serve this as a no-knock warrant, we probably wouldn't be here, because Kenneth Walker wouldn't have known anyone was coming in and wouldn't have grabbed a gun, worrying that intruders were coming in, which is what he has said. So could a no-knock warrant have been very beneficial in this case? Possibly. We're not going to know. Officers probably determined that because they thought this was a stash house where drugs were being kept or transported, that there wasn't as much risk as some of the other locations, which is why they chose to knock and announce. And I understand that. It is, again, a tragic case. However, it doesn't mean that the police are criminally responsible. And nothing that we have seen changes my mind on that. And if other stuff comes out, I might change my mind on that. But based on everything that I have seen and all the questions I've been asked, most of those questions are people wanting to understand better or not wanting this outcome to be the way it is, no matter what. And I understand that too. Sometimes you just don't want to hear it. And I get it. But there's no indication that there is anything wrong here. What happened is tragic nonetheless. So other than, I would like to see more about the warrant, but we have a lot of leaked documents that support that warrant on what the investigative report says. And there's quite a lot of recorded jail calls in that and a lot of other evidence that backs up why that warrant was being served for evidence. And again, the warrant was being served on Breonna Taylor's apartment to search for evidence, not to arrest her, but to search her home and her car for evidence with regard to the ongoing drug investigation, which is completely proper. So to that end, it doesn't matter if the target of the drug investigation was already in custody because they were searching her home for evidence, not for him. So while I understand people have continued to make statements to the media saying that they want more justice in this case, what I see is a case where a search warrant was served, police were fired upon, and returned fire. I don't think the race of the police officers involved or the people at the end of the hallway would have changed the outcome in this particular case, because when police officers are fired on, they are going to fire back and be justified in doing so. I also don't think the knock, no-knock warrant debate on this case has much weight with the outcome on this case, because what happened happened. If they had knocked and announced, or if they had not knocked and announced, either way, if they were fired upon, they would have fired back. So the crux of it becomes they were fired upon, because that's what triggered their next actions, and the fact that they were there properly. And that also goes to their own defense. They were lawfully where they were supposed to be. They had a lawful warrant. If stuff comes out on the warrant, I will be very interested to see it. But even if it does, and I talked about this in the other episode, even if there's anything off with the warrant or any of the information that's underlying the warrant is stale, the officers are still allowed to rely on the warrant in good faith. And that is considered proper for their actions. It throws out the evidence that they obtain in court if the warrant's not proper, but it doesn't change them lawfully being there because they're relying on the warrant in good faith. So even if there is something up with the warrant, which I don't think that there is, but even if there were, it still doesn't change the analysis on charging these particular officers. So there's really not much left other than explanations that would be helpful because the public wants them, but it's not going to change whether these officers should be charged. Questions around the warrant, which is an ongoing investigation, which only goes to evidence taken out of Taylor's house, which at this point is basically moot because of the rest of the investigation and because the attention that this part has drawn. I imagine that when you're prosecuting Marcus Glover, you don't even want to bring in anything that has to do with this in relation to that drug investigation as it goes forward into the criminal prosecution of the drug bust. So there isn't much here that's going to change the officers being charged. They're not going to be charged because they were lawfully doing what they were lawfully allowed to do. It doesn't make it less tragic. But looking for more than the $12 million civil settlement, the changes in the law, and the other policy changes that have happened is going to come up with nothing. And that is just what it is on this case. I will leave in the show notes all of the links to all of the things that I've talked about and all of the videos I've done regarding this case if you want even more information. As always, you can hit me up in the Get Legit Launch community and we can talk about it. I appreciate the Get Legit crew. I appreciate you for hanging in there with this very, very long episode. And new thing, if you want to, you can text me. I know we have texting now. We can text. So you can text in and let me know if you have questions about this episode at 615-455-3216. And that will be in the show notes too. I hope to see you all up in my text messages and I will talk to you soon. Take care. Thanks for sticking around for today's episode. For episodes like this and conversations like this, come join us in the Facebook community. The Get Legit community is where we discuss the episodes, where I answer your questions, and we have an opportunity to take a deeper dive in a respectful, conversational environment. The Get Legit community is on Facebook. There's a link down below, or you can go to getlegitlive.com. I'll see you on the inside.